This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Jane Taylor on the Handspring Puppet Company, a talk held in conjunction with the opening of the company's production War Horse in New York. It took place on April 12th, 2011.
I'm Sina Najafi. Welcome to Cabinet for tonight's event with Jane Taylor, who I'm sure you all know. Jane is based in South Africa and is a curator, scholar, and writer. And she gave a fantastic talk here last year that some of you might have been on the collaboration she did with William Kentridge on the production of The Nose that Kentridge did here last year. And so we're very pleased to have her back here again to talk to us about Handspring Puppet, with whom she's collaborate on a number of occasions, and you are the CEO, I believe, at Handspring Trust as well. Please join me in welcoming Jane Taylor. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Can everyone hear me okay? Are the sound levels right? I want, first of all, to once again thank Cabinet for making this space available. There's something incredibly special about the ways in which small collectives like this decide what they need and help each other create environments for public conversation. And it's astonishing to be able to just come in from out of town and find an environment that's so facilitating of a conversation I'm interested in having with you. So I really do appreciate that, Sina and Josh and everybody who is involved in Cabinet and holding the idea of a public space in such careful regard. I'm also delighted to say that Basil and Adrian from Handspring Puppet Company are here this evening, so any interrogations that you might want to make about puppetry arts, and for those of you who might have seen War Horse, if you want to engage in discussion with them, I'll make sure that we have plenty of time for an open kind of dialogue at the end of my conversation. I also need to make a small prefatory remark, because for the past 2 weeks I've been involved with colleagues from Handspring at a conference on puppetry in Connecticut, and that rolled itself into a public conversation at CUNY last week. So I've got a slight disquiet about presenting familiar material to some of the traveling companions who may be here this evening. So I'm going to split the difference, as it were. I'm going to recapitulate some of the material while also raising some alternative questions for thinking about Handspring and their work. So then the first series of meditations arises in relation to the question of the subject and its objects, beings and things in their tangled world. So then, of subjects. Here I'm referring to that complex interactive personhood that we take more or less as equivalent to the self. Well, perhaps it's too sweeping an assertion to flatten out selfhood and subjectivity so lightly, given decades of Anglo and continental disputes about the absolute differences between the two notions. The self, as a concept, emerges from the traditions of liberal individualism and suggests an authorial agency in one's own existence. I live the life that I craft. While the subject, as understood from continental theories of discourse, has it that the subject is not so much the one who speaks as the one who is spoken, produced by ideologies that persuade the being of its agency. Nonetheless, we must proceed, so let's hold on to this minimal anchor and let us, for our discussion, name this being the subject. This subject, psychoanalysis tells us, is precipitated into its subjectivity through the object, that being or thing or token onto which the subject can project, be taken out of itself, and which can be interjected, be taken into itself. What puppetry demonstrates is what psychoanalysis knows, that subjects and objects do not exist in discrete categories. Rather, the world is constituted of relations situated along a continuum between an eventful autonomy on one hand and a posited passivity on the other. we flow or rock back and forth, as it were, between the limit terms, beings and things. The puppet mysteriously threads its precarious life. Let us say life as an act of optimism, as a sign of our commitment to the as-if reality of the puppet world. So then the puppet threads its life along that seam between objecthood and subjectivity, challenging us to recognize when it crosses over the threshold from one state to the other, or to notice when it falls off the balance beam, so to speak. These are the primary terms through which I understand what puppets are doing. Basil Jones, from Handspring, meanwhile, has suggested that the arts of puppetry depend on an animism that is integral to our species' history. That belief in the secret life of objects lives on, as it were, and our rapture before the puppet is at recovering an object world that is thick with meanings that somehow are independent of us. So then, a cultural phylogeny, the history of our species, is stored in the meaning of the puppet for Jones. My interest doesn't exclude this reading, although my understanding of the significance of the puppet points primarily to the formation of the individual. The infant child is an inchoate and incompetent bundle, and it's through the work of imaginative projection in a dialogic circuit that such a one becomes invested with the personhood of its caregiver, becomes an agent. We are predisposed to believe in the potential of the puppet because our lives depend on it. So I'm going to begin with an image from Wojciech, the first production that brought together the talents of Handspring and the artist-director William Kentridge in 1989. In this scene, the doomed protagonist, Maria, talks to her infant child, revealing her longings. There's an extraordinary sense of the social conglomerate that allows for the emergence of identity, because here we have visible to us the two puppets, infant and mother, as well as three puppeteers. Basil Jones, behind the playboard, manipulates the infant. Busi Zakufa is the voice and left arm of Maria, and Adrian Kohler's hand is visible manipulating Maria's right arm. Clearly, there's a complex choreography necessary to pull off such a trick. Despite the fact that Western culture is dominated by the iconographies of the biblical nativity in countless paintings, drawings, and sculptures, and numberless school plays, generally, the infant is performed by a bundle of rags rolled up in a blanket. As Jones has noted, it's really only through the puppet that the infant can be meaningfully performed on stage, with the psychodynamics of the reproductive unit giving agency to that child. Another privileged inquiry into the subject-object continuum within the work of Handspring relates to the status of the animal. So it is at one level a philosophical question. How do I live ethically in a relationship with other consciousnesses if I am the heir of a philosophical tradition that says that I have rights of dominion over all other species and life forms in my world? At the same time, it's an aesthetic and a performance question. How do I make a puppet of an animal? How do I give it life and a kind of existential subjectivity? How do I give a piece of wood those instruments of awareness and attention that we associate with the animal? How do I demonstrate the acuity of its senses? In some ways, the natural assumption is that a puppet ideally is there because it can represent the non-human world. This is part of the legacy of standard thinking about puppets. I can't see why we would want a human being as a puppet, though I can see why I would want a horse or a fish or a demon or a ghost in puppet form. That binary logic is one that Handspring have contested throughout their work, and they've retained a scrupulous commitment to the exploration of both human and non-human puppet forms. In the original proposal to John Sleman at the Baxter Theatre in Cape Town some 30 years ago about making a puppet version of Midsummer Night's Dream, Basil and Adrian originally conceived a project that would break down the kingdom of fairy-human realm divide. In actuality, though, Sleman embraced the idea of a puppet show for adults precisely because he imagined the capacity that puppets would bring to the representation of the non-human world. The arts of representation and performance have shifted massively since those days, allowing us to imagine in completely different ways how objects might perform themselves on stage. And a lot of that shift has been a result of Handspring's aesthetic and performance impact. In some ways, the problem is predictable. The expectation is always that puppetry is the medium through which to perform the animal, the monster, the supernatural. During those early years, it was all but impossible to persuade backers of the viability of the puppet as a medium in its own right. So here's the design for that production of Midsummer Night's Dream. And the design is strongly influenced by the sculpture and puppetry traditions of Mali, which have had an enormous aesthetic impact on Basil and Adrian's own practice. There's a distinctive and advanced puppetry culture in Mali, which has been key to the working of themselves as puppeteers in Africa. And the Malian tradition is the one very distinctive African tradition that has some links to other puppetry traditions elsewhere in the world, but is a uniquely African form. Animals, though, do retain a privileged space within Handspring's work, and they are variously treated. In some of their productions, the animal is, as far as possible, imagined for its remote animality, its distance from the human. In Buchner's Wojciech, there's a scene with a horse being trained to perform autonomy of thought. It's interesting to think that in this early work of theirs, there's now a kind of implicit cycle with the question returning in a wholly different way through Warhorse. Kentridge and Handspring, though, resolved to use a different beast rather than the horse. They used the rhinoceros as their emblematic figure for that captive wild. So here is the rhinoceros in performance, and this is to give you some idea of the sort of expressive mark and also the technologies, the crafting of joints and so on, the maneuverable parts that Adrian Kohler, the master puppeteer, embeds in the animal itself. In the Wojciech production, the animal is trained to simulate the act of counting in a test to determine whether the animal has anything akin to our notion of consciousness. The hyena in Faustus in Africa is what Basil Jones has called a bad second lieutenant figure. It can talk, has human appetites, and a Machiavellian streak. The hyena's attributes are those of popular legend, yet as a diabolical familiar, it has some human attributes. One small detail that's worth noting here about how these technical solutions evolve for Handspring: the hyena at one stage has to play drafts, and so has to be able to put its paw onto a draft and manipulate it on the board. And so it has an articulated foot. And that articulated foot eventually will evolve into something of the design of the hoof that you see in performance in Warhorse. Other animals include the part mythological creature Brutus, a three-headed dog that represented the various elements of state power in the production Ubu and the Truth Commission, a work made around the 1990s and the commission hearings at the end of the age of apartheid. The beast is a combination of naturalistic performance, with each dog head as literally as a dog head, but with mythological significance. And the three-headed beast invokes Cerberus, the keeper of the gate of Hades. Here, the animals only bark and perform themselves as purely animal. They don't partake of the consciousness evident in the figure of the hyena. The Chimp Project inaugurates a new kind of inquiry through which Handspring began to investigate what could be learned about non-human species to and for themselves on the one hand, as well as in their complex relations with humans. This production was the culmination of years spent investigating recent research into primate intelligence, in particular positing questions about language transmission and interspecies communication. One of the core questions raised in the production had arisen through research in the field. Is it possible that a chimp that has learned to communicate via signing with humans will spontaneously transmit that sign language to other chimps in the wild? Does the process of acculturation get transmitted, either socially or generationally? The Chimp Project raises the question through a young chimp, Lisa, at the center of the drama, who escapes into the wild. Would she pass on sign language to her offspring? The play asks. In the scientific literature, opinion is divided, although recent research suggests that the transmission of sign language between chimps can take place via the informal process of communicative eavesdropping. Here, chimps pick up vocabulary through watching signing between other chimps that have been formally trained. And it's been suggested that this more closely mimics the usual transmission of language within human communities. The production Tall Horse, based on the story of a giraffe given as a diplomatic gift to the King of France by Egypt in the 19th century, looks in historically specific ways at how the Enlightenment court became captive to the idea of the remote and distinctive animal as that which represented the antithesis of European civility and culture. You can see from the images how strong an aesthetic shift there was for this production. Handspring developed the piece with a Malian puppet company, and the idioms and aesthetics of the production invoke the intercultural rapture triggered by French appetite for all things giraffe in the 19th century. Adrian Kohler was able to enjoy the deft and economical solutions applied to the making of puppets by Yahya Koulibaly, whose swift ads-made figures arrived with frightening rapidity at Adrian's door. I'm going to include here, for technical interest, an image that is of a puppet human. We see the ways in which Yahya, as a craftsman, has adapted the backpack-style engineering of his tradition. And here he wears the figure much as one would wear an ice cream tray as a vendor at the movies, strapped onto the body in order to allow for freedom of movement of the puppeteer's arms. Interestingly, an entirely distinct but similar experiment had been conducted by Jones and Kohler in an early work of theirs, Tooth and Nail, directed by Malcolm Perkey. The photographer puppet, Saul, is strapped to Jones's body, and the two literally walk in lockstep. These technical matters are in some measure part of the interest of Warhorse, so it seems very productive to consider how solutions arise in the process of making as part of meaning production. And there are two rather fabulous images of Basil inside the Saul suit, which he's sort of steering almost like the prow of a ship in front of him as he maneuvers around the stage. In the most recent Handspring production, Or You Could Kiss Me, one of the puppets is a domestic dog. As Jones has indicated, we now live in approximate relationship to animals, such as we have not done in quite the same way before. Dogs are part of our affective universe. During the seasons of extended performance tours, Jones elaborates in an interview, in cities around the world, friends and colleagues provide the social and familial substructure of the professional player's world, but it is the chance encounters with cats and dogs in sundry homes which legitimate an affectionate and tactile exchange of caresses and tender attention. The relations with humans are frequently bound by greater considerations of constraint and inhibition. And Jones identifies how their work has increasingly sought to pay regard to the bonds of interspecies communion and dependency upon which human existence is now premised. Thus, the non-human, and that experiment has culminated in the achievement of Warhorse. And I'll return to a brief discussion of Warhorse at the end of my talk, as this is the direct trigger for our conversation this evening. But before I do that, I want to turn to the distinctive work that Handspring have developed within the representation of the human. And in some ways, this is the fingerprint of what Handspring has been doing for some decades. Over the years, it's become evident that Handspring's experiment was generating a kind of radical exploration specifically within this inquiry, the human. I'm going to look quite closely at that production of Buchner's Wojciech, which I opened with earlier. What is discovered in the making of this work is the particular ways in which the Bunraku puppetry traditions can be deployed in making experiments in the form and staging of the human subject. With Bunraku, the human figure, usually about two-thirds of life size, is performed by several manipulators working together. The puppeteers are generally dressed in black, and in certain traditions, they will wear gauze veils to cover their faces. Handspring experimented in an early production, Star Brights, directed by Barney Simon, that made use of the fully effaced puppeteers. And you can see here, this, it's about a musical troupe getting their act together and going back on the road as performers. And the cluster that you see in the center here is two figures with the traditional Bunraku black outfits and the black gauze hiding their faces. And the illusionism is to use the figure effectively as a kind of a screen in front of which the puppet performs a kind of autonomous dance. So what interests me is the commitment to this question of the relationship between the puppeteer and the puppet in an experiment around unbounded identities. And I think, if I consider it, part of what's happening in the whole process of the invention of this idiom for Handspring is a tacit understanding of what goes into social formations. If one thinks that this work is being produced in 1989, which is at the end, really, of the years of emergency in the apartheid state, part of what I think Handspring is trying to present on the stage is the way in which an entire invisible constituency of a workforce is holding in the air, fabricating into existence the life force of another community that effectively relies upon them for its identity. So this landmark production, the Wojciech, based on Buchner's play, signals the complex nexus of mutually dependent beings that's come to signify the work. The figure Wojciech is at once a sensual and metaphysical being of huge emotional longing and philosophic melancholy. Yet he has, through his experiences as a soldier, become a blunted and grim man with lethal potential. Here are some close-ups of the figure of the Wojciech character, and you get to see also here in quite nice detail the expressive mark that Adrian Kohler has introduced. Both Adrian and Basil were raised in a fine art tradition and then moved from fine arts into puppetry. So in some ways, these are sculptural forms as much as they are puppets. Also, one of the interesting things that you see in this expressive face is that Kohler's very attentive to the fact that the human face is always asymmetrical. And the asymmetry in the human face is something that then gets realized for its dramatic capacity, because as the puppet is held in a slightly different inflection, different expressive possibilities are enlivened in that face, even though the face itself is entirely static and fixed in a single impression, the illusion that we have. And that's part of the fabulous dynamism of the puppetry performance, is that the puppet relies on our projective understanding of what the face is saying. The face is not actually changing, but through the relationship between the bodies and the text, I project what I need to interpret, what I need to understand of the shifting imaginative horizon internal to the puppet figure that we're watching. At one point in the production, as Wojciech lays the dining table, he's in the service of a doctor who is conducting minimal behavioral experiments on him. We see the figure looking at the table, lost in a kind of reverie about his incompetence in the world. And here you see on either side of the character the two different puppeteers, Louis and Adrian, each of them bringing an entirely different kind of attention and different kind of genius. Adrian is the master puppeteer, so all of the kind of deft, fine work that the puppet needs to mobilize in order to animate his world is at some level going to be done on the right-hand side of the puppet, where Adrian's extraordinarily acute attention to the physical manipulation is going on. But Louis is the one who has the expressive genius. He is a truly astonishing performer to watch. And you can see in the, as you watch a series of stills from the performance, that you'll see this kind of attention in Adrian going into the site of the manipulation of the object. And over and over again, you'll see in Louis' expressive performance, his attention is going into the mentality of the puppet. So there is this very complex dynamism inside the puppet himself, who partakes of the dual character of the two performers. And it's one of the things that Kentridge himself reflects upon in the making of the work, that he can always rely on an almost schizoid potential in the puppet, because the puppet is being constituted through the bridge between the two different performers, who are each presenting the kind of poetic, imaginative, philosophical capacity on the one hand, and the emotional intensity on the other, in producing this kind of complex conglomerate that is a very nuanced human being. Kentridge is interesting too, because this was the first puppetry project that he was engaged in. Up until that point, he had been undertaking. I suspect that many people saw the Kentridge productions and the Kentridge exhibitions that were on in New York last year. Primarily an animator at that stage, and his animation endeavors were always extraordinarily time intensive. He made what he referred to as drawings for projection. So if you can imagine, if you are changing the expression of a human face, what he would do is he would draw the face, walk back three or four paces, film a couple of frames, return to the image, erase a fragment, move the line, change the expression of the face, move back to his camera, film for a few seconds, move back to the face, erase a few lines, manipulate the image, walk back again. So it would take him, 3 weeks to make 3 minutes of film. And it became an insanely costly project. And he had a voracious imagination, and he wanted to be making 10 productions a day rather than, one production a year. So he tried to imagine how he might more economically animate an expressive individual inside a more temporally economic drawn landscape. How could he make an animation figure that would enable him to work more rapidly inside the medium? And he thought that if he worked with Handspring, whose work he had come to know and admire at that stage, he might be able to imagine the puppet figure as something with an almost real-time capacity to reflect the changing arc of expression and so on, without falling captive to the naturalism of a live performer. And Kentridge has always resisted working inside the idioms of kind of advanced naturalism in film, because he likes that kind of defamiliarizing effect both of animation and of theater. So he stays inside languages that resist the human being performing the human being. So I think the puppet for him was a kind of solution that had the kind of fluidity of movement of the human, but didn't fall into the same kind of naturalistic obtuseness. Part of what this interdisciplinary dialogue with Handspring produced for Kentridge was an understanding that nothing is forbidden, because he was working inside an idiom that he didn't understand. And he said that he would go over and over again to Adrian, expecting Adrian to be able to fulfill the promise of their contract between one another, that even though he had no idea of how to provide a solution or whether such a solution was possible, he constantly put that pressure on Adrian, knowing that Adrian would be able to solve it. So in a way, he came up with problems outside of the proper for puppetry, because he didn't know what was an improper demand, an improper question, because he assumed that those limits would be inside Adrian. And of course, Adrian, in his defensive narcissistic need, had to always provide the solution that Kentridge was requiring. So both of them maximized the kind of creative mayhem out of the pressure of working together, and I think in a way really exceeded anything that either of them had anticipated. So, for example, you see this kind of encounter where the menace against the puppet becomes so intense and unmediated, because there's the slippage of live performance into the puppet domain, which summons up the mortality of the puppet in very particular ways and makes the blade into a much more substantial thing. So these sort of transgressive spaces between media was something of the pressure that gets produced in that kind of dialogue through the incomprehension of one another's arts. There's another very instructive moment in which there is a miner who is performing, a kind of bravado stick dance using his shovels as swagger sticks that he's twirling around his head. This is, as you can imagine, difficult enough for a live performer, but extremely tricky for a puppet. And the strategy is to have the hands of the puppeteers honestly grasp the handles. The thing that's so surprising about this is how remarkably tolerable this is for the audience, who make no complaint about such solutions. And one of the other things that we note when we look at this image is that we see again that the miner is played by two puppeteers. And here we have Basil Jones and again Louis Sobocco, as we see from the next image, the two of them again performing the single unified subjectivity of the miner. And again, you see in Louis Sobocco's extraordinarily expressive being the projection of the self into the puppet. So the mentality of the puppet is held aloft through a kind of trust in the puppeteering event, at the same time as the dexterity and the physicality of the puppet is also being regarded. Here, the puppeteers are clearly visible, and we get a sense of this kind of dispersed field of a collectivity of being across various different bodies. But you can also see how variable the use of the playboard. The playboard is the much more traditional performance device in which the puppeteer actually masks their body behind a playboard so that we see the puppet appear as if they are autonomous and engaging in a universe of their own. And it's quite nice because you can see this is in a rehearsal, so you can see the feet of the puppeteer below here. But that disproportionate height between the feet and the torso helps you to understand that in that space between, masked by the playboard, is the body of the puppeteer, who is at this stage holding the Bunraku puppet above their head. So apart from anything else, the kind of acrobatic effect and the kind of physical competence of the performers is something pretty extraordinary. But part of what we understand that can happen through this shift between that kind of puppetry where we have the human being being produced as a kind of social organism across the arc of the puppeteers to this kind of event where you have the puppeteer effectively isolated, when the play moves into a kind of an existential mode where you have the puppet in total isolation against this kind of ice blue field of the projected animation of Kentridge, an entirely different affective and emotive meaning is made possible. So part of the interest and the competence in the apprehension of what's going on in the making of that work is that shift between the different horizons of performance, the different kinds of performance, the different kinds of subjectivity implied in that collective and the individual and isolated body. At some points, interestingly, because of the demands of voice, for example, a puppeteer will have to hand over his or her puppet in mid-performance to another puppeteer, giving rise to an impromptu radical experiment in intersubjective identities. I spent one rather astonishing evening trying to understand, trying to capture how these alchemical processes work. So I watched the whole performance from backstage, and there are really quite uncanny things that one becomes aware of. So, for example, before one of the puppeteers advances into a space in which they will be seen, for example, they will stand backstage and move with the puppet in a kind of cajoling, rhythmic entering of the self into the puppet, particularly if there's a musical event or anything of that kind. So the appropriation of the subjectivity of the puppet happens in the beats before the puppet appears on stage. So there is a kind of a porous horizon in which the self is the self to the puppet before the performance begins, so that when the puppet enters into the sight line with the audience, that possession, that inhabitation of the puppet by the puppeteer has taken place in this kind of sleeve of time and space before the performance actually begins. So they're, you know, really pretty extraordinary, uncanny transformation scene. One of the other things that's also pretty thrilling to watch backstage is that, of course, the casting of a puppet can be entirely outside of race and gender. So you can have various kind of mixes of identities happening behind the stage and different attributes being brought to the puppet, tenderness muscularity and all sorts of things implicit in the performance of that being precisely because the puppet is a conglomerate of these different kinds of attributes from puppeteers who come from a much more radical social universe than the rest of us do. Okay, so I want, just before moving back to show you a clip from Warhorse, to look at just a couple of images of Warhorse. I don't know if anybody here has been to see any of the previews. I'm quite interested in this slide because you get to see different manipulation strategies deployed in the same space, almost a kind of across a continuum of technological experiment. Because the little girl figure that you see on the one side is and she's no longer in the production because for all sorts of technical as well as narratological reasons. But at this stage, she was part of the London production, and she is being manipulated by two figures who look roughly like mechanics who are wearing basic blacks. And those basic blacks at some level mimic what one understands from the Bunraku tradition. They sort of fall out of the field of vision and become effectively a playboard or a screen against which the little girl is performed. But inside that same space is the real achievement of the apprehension of the manipulation of Warhorse. Because the young man standing next to the horse, more or less as the horse's minder, Craig Leo, is actually the manipulator of the head of the horse puppet. He has a kind of a long metal shaft which is attached to the horse's head, which is ever-present. When the horses are on stage, there are two figures inside the body of the horse, and the horse is worn effectively in something like an adaptation of the Malian backpack puppet. So you have, as Basil and Adrian have characterized it, the horse is roughly one hand larger than any horse in nature, because the horse has to be just big enough to have the human being, the manipulator, with the horse braced on their shoulders inside the puppet. So you have two figures inside the horse, and then this figure that is manipulating the head. So every time you look at the horse, there is this event of someone managing the horse somewhere there, but we read that entirely naturalistically. We see these puppeteers not as manipulators as the horse, but as of men handling their horses. So invisibility is a kind of a deft achievement in Warhorse of a very particular kind. And you can see, particularly this figure here, you can see a manipulation apparatus and a gun and various different things all become confused in the imagination of the viewer in a way that makes that landscape with the horse something larger than the horse itself. And here again, there's Craig Leo sitting beside his horse in a completely amiable, affectionate dialogue with the horse as the horse minder, and it allows us to entirely occlude the fact from ourselves that what we're actually watching here is a manipulator sitting outside of the puppet with a brace inserted into the puppet's neck. So I'm going to show us a small clip from the film of the making of Warhorse, and then I think we'll just open up to generalized conversation, partly because we've got Basil and Adrian here to engage in a dialogue with us about the actual practice of making and the practice of performing. And any questions that you have arising from the clip or from either seeing production or reading about the production, we'll have a kind of free-for-all exchange. So what I need to do now is animate that field of vision. So.
Because it's on the eyes immediately, because they have a kind of a gloss and they're dark and they pick up the theater lights. They allow you into the head of the horse.
You've got to be able to breathe for the object and breathe with the object. And very often you're working as a team. And the only way that you can really communicate with other people who are operating together with you on the same object is through breath. You know, you've got one person standing in the back who operates the back legs and tail. You've got the chap who stands in inside the body of the puppet that operates the front legs. And we refer to him as the heart. And then there's somebody that operates the head who is completely visible and stands outside the puppet. And is in control of the ears and the neck movement and the head movement. And we were always told by the directors, Tom and Marianne, that the horses need to be horses. They're not supposed to be well behaved. They must always remain animals. And animals
cue a lot of signals within their puppet.
pass the ball to each other, which is what we called it, where all three puppeteers don't operate their bits of the horse at the same time. Otherwise, you're loading the audience with information and they don't know where to look or what the horse is feeling. So a lot of it became about kind of doing less. And there's an added complication with the horses because you can't see what everyone else is doing. You're strapped into this structure, so I can't see what my back legs are doing. And if the head goes above a certain height, I can't really see what the head's doing either. So we've found various techniques. There are things like, because I'm physically strapped into the guy behind me, if I move slightly to the left or to the right, he can feel that. And the more we get used to each other's way of moving, the easier it is to sort of indicate, oh, I want to do this now, or you know, someone else can start that movement and move in another way. If there are big sort of complicated moves to do that are fast or dangerous, we have a series of calls that we use to each other. So we'll use blows that sound maybe a little bit like something the horse might do anyway, but that we can recognize as not just vocalizing to make the horse seem realistic, but as a signal that we're about to do something. So if we're about to run off, for instance, really fast, you might go, and then everyone else can just hear that little noise, and off we go. The crows, the goose and the foal, and the soldier puppets. The puppeteer is equally visible to the audience as the puppet, sometimes more so. Frequently they're much bigger than the puppet itself. So, and the goose is just a great example of that. Finn Caldwell and Al Najari, who work the goose, find slightly different ways of working the goose when they're performing. But there's an amazing concentration of the puppeteer's physicality, and his focus feeds totally down this long rod towards the goose puppet. When you come out with some wood that's made into a certain shape, and you're implying to the audience, I'm going to play a game with you. Do you want to play back? And if they stay and they watch, then they say they're playing back. They're playing back. They're agreeing to play this game. And it's like playing with toys, and I think it invites adults to go, wow, I can be open to this. It's like I'm a child again. And I think that's why they have such strong emotional reaction to the show.
It became really difficult in the beginning, because the tendency as an actor or performer is to listen to the dialogue. Now, an animal doesn't necessarily understand English. And certainly horses, we know, have a very specific language of their own, which we had to learn. But the only way I could really access the mind of a horse is to stop listening to the text, stop listening to the dialogue, and start to kind of gauge the kind of temperature of a scene or the levels of anxiety that the humans around are working on. So, for example, in the stable scene in the very beginning of the play, you've got Albert who gets really, really upset because his father's trying to sell the horse. And all I would do is I wouldn't actually listen to the words he was saying, but I would listen to his levels of anxiety. And as his levels would rise, that's how I would react. I would know that there was a problem. And as he calmed down, I would calm down.
It's all right. It's all right.
Working with the horse puppets, in preparation, before I even met the Joey and Top Form, before I met the puppets themselves in action, I went and spent a lot of time with real horses, thinking that I have to project a lot of what a real horse is onto the puppet. But actually, when I walked into the room for the first time and met Joey as a moving, living horse, it's very easy actually to believe that it is a horse without having to project anything upon it. There's not much acting required in that area, because it's so instinctive and in the moment and breathing and living that there's not much actor's imagination required.
Joey boy, when I call Joey like that, he'll always know it's me, Albert. That's a good start, Joey. That's a good start, boy.
One of the astonishing pieces of information that one learns if you read the research done for the making of the production was that they estimate that some 8 million horses died during the First World War. And I know that, you know, one has or receives a sort of naturalized account of how during the 20s and the 30s agriculture and the farming industry were mechanized and modernized, and one absorbs that at some level as part of a narrative of the progress and modernization of human society. But in fact, when you think about those implications, you understand that after the First World War, agriculture and the countryside could never be the same again with the loss of 8 million horses. And so at some level, the story of modernity and the change in structure to farming is the story of a catastrophe rather than a story of celebration of our advance. So I'm going to invite questions of any kind and ask Basil and Adrian to make themselves available for any kind of discussion that might seem interesting to people. About puppetry, about this production. Yeah.
If it's not too cheeky, if it's not too cheeky to ask, what were the technical questions and dramaturgical considerations that led to the little girl puppet being cut from the production?
They're pretty interesting responses.
quite a simple answer, really. It was quite difficult for a puppeteer on his or her knees, manipulating the feet of the little girl, to run helter-skelter across the National Theatre stage every night comfortably. It's a very big stage, and in order for the child to live as a child enjoying herself in a space, it really became hard for people to do that convincingly using a puppet. And when we decided to say goodbye to the puppet and replace the puppet with a little girl, we were happy and relieved, mainly for the poor puppeteer on his knees.
And that's also one of the consequences of moving away from a playboard. And I mean, part of what you've been exploring over the last couple of years is this kind of free-form puppetry, where puppetry can happen in a three-dimensional space without any designated location for the puppet, that the puppet gains a kind of dynamism and energy and volatility in relation to where it can move, but then the limitations are that the puppeteer somehow has to be dragged behind the puppet across those vast spaces. Yeah.
Yes, it's my department. each horse is actually a body with eight legs and two heads and two necks. And they can do pit stops during the production. When we opened the play in London, we didn't know what we had. And, you know, it was an experiment, a very expensive one by that stage, with the National Theatre were quaking about at the time. The puppets had survived 2 months of rehearsal, no problem, but came tech week, suddenly we were sitting in the back row of the theater and we get an emergency call that the hooves have collapsed, and we had to run backstage. There was tremendous traffic suddenly backstage in the dark, costume changes, tanks coming on, and panic. And that's when the horses started to break. So we needed spare parts so they can do a pit stop, they can change a leg in the dark, just by pulling a pin and putting a new one on now. And then it goes for major surgery later.
Yeah.
Well, firstly, thank you for this fantastic presentation. pleasure to be in the dialogue. I'm not going to hold that. We've been in an interesting dialogue for the last days. I'm very grateful for it. And you were mentioning the other day how there's a sort of a zen that the puppeteers get into, a zen state where they have to, where you really also have to almost have to evacuate your own being into the puppet. You become invisible. The puppet is the star, not the puppeteer. Having just seen War Horse, I don't remember any of the puppeteers, really. But I remember the horse, the puppets, very well. So, we've been talking about the way in which we project ourselves onto the puppets. But I'm wondering what the puppeteers, and you as puppeteers, introject from the puppets back into yourselves. How do the puppets affect you?
That is a very interesting question. To be a puppeteer does mean that there's nobody waiting at the stage door to get your autograph. some people say that puppeteers are shy actors because they have a mask of a puppet in front of them, and they communicate with the audience through that object. And I think that's really what you get back. You do get back you do get back the pleasure of, if you've given a good show, you get back the pleasure of the audience that hasn't had to deal with you as Adrian on the stage. They can simply deal with the character. And this, in a way, there isn't a barrier to their imagination, the imaginative idea of who that character is. And you get that back. It somehow comes back to you. The magic in the theater when there's a good show going on makes the show effortless for you for a start, even though it's a physical exercise. And you walk out of the theater with that in your head.
I think one of the other real gifts to the puppeteers of particularly working together in a group of, say, three people, as happens with the horses, is that you have this feeling of a conspiracy of being. You conspire, you breathe together to create another human, and indeed in this case it's an animal, another being, and when that's done really successfully, when you're working this sort of strange osmosis of communication between you, where as Finn Caldwell said, there's a little and everyone knows that what that means. On the night when you decide to be disobedient on stage and not comply with what the actors are expecting of you, the human actors, that conspiracy of being is an amazing state to be in, very, very rewarding and I think quite unique. A little similar, I'm told, to dance, when three dancers are dancing together on stage. And, of course, puppetry is a form of choreography, but it's a very rewarding thing, that.
Yeah.
The more I hear of you, Jane. I have a question about the translation of the children's book into the stage play, where one of the defining factors of the book has been reverted. The horse no longer speaks, and the story is no longer told through the animal. How did you come about to that decision? And maybe, Jane, you would have a comment on it, since you've been instrumental in writing some of the plays that Handspring Puppet Company has performed before?
I would have to defer to Basil and Adrian on this question, except insofar as I'm really interested in the shifts, the sort of strategic choices that some of the animals are fully realized. You know, as we say, you know, the hyena talks, it has an identifiably human consciousness, whereas the chimp is recognized to have a consciousness, but that consciousness is one that can only sign, and we apprehend through a language of metaphorics what the chimp might be saying to us. But I think that working with Mopuga and the National Theatre was incredibly anxious about the idea that it would be staging as one of their big productions an event in which your sentimental attachment is to something that's not going to speak from the stage. Can you talk a bit about that, the dynamic with the National Theatre and the imagination for what a horse could bring to the show?
It was clear to everyone right from the start that the horse wouldn't speak. There was never any debate about that. We all realized that it would be a travesty if the horse spoke on stage, I think. We didn't want any Black Beauty happening. But it's also true that the National Theatre was extremely anxious coming out of a city where word is king, and word in the theatre is king, to be doing a production where the central character was on stage for 2 hours and never spoke. They didn't know whether they could pull that off, we were always quite confident that we could, although, of course, we didn't know either. It has been a big experiment, and there was quite a bit of politics around that, because in the theatre, at the National Theatre, the only person who receives royalties in a National Theatre production is the writer. And we argued very strongly that we, as puppeteers, had an authorial contribution to the production. We argued very, very strongly that we deserved to share the royalty as writers. We lost that argument then, partially because the National said, well, you know, if we have to acknowledge your authoriality here, we would have to acknowledge authoriality from choreographers in physical theatre pieces where there was minimal language in the past. How do we deal with that? But it's true that when we did Or You Could Kiss Me with Neil Bartlett the following 2 years later at the National Theatre, Neil very graciously almost made it a condition that the authorship would be shared between the puppeteers and himself. And so for the first time in history, the National Theatre shared the authorship royalty between the puppeteers and the author. When people say to us, but you used to do such interesting political work, I say we still do political work, but it's a different kind of politics that we're doing. And nevertheless, I think it's worthwhile, and we're just working in a different sphere.
Now it no longer, the horse at least, it no longer speaks as a real horse doesn't. And the book compared to that is the more abstract form of a horse.
In a book, I suppose, if you're writing a book about a horse, then how's the horse going to communicate, because it's not a visual medium, the novel. But I think for us, as puppeteers and as people making theatre, the animal as animal rather than the animal as anthropomorphized animal is a more interesting subject. It's a more interesting exploration. We've come all the way. You know, all our early work was for children's shows in the beginning was with talking animals. So I guess we've tried that out. And the exploring the languages that animals have between them as much as we can comprehend from our human perspective is a much more interesting task.
And I think also part of what's interesting in a production like this is what's precipitated in the humans by the animal, and to see the sort of the horizons of the possible for human animality, you know, for the passions and so on, that is legitimated and made available to the human subjects because of the co-presence with animals. And I think that probably in the 21st century, there's a way in which that becomes one of the pressing questions of our time, is what is our interspecies obligation? What are, you know, as we are losing all of those resources around us and seeing them kind of diminishing from our sphere of engagement, the question of who we are in relation to the animal begins to weigh quite heavy on us. So I think it's part of our the philosophical inquiry of our moment. And I know that Basil and Adrian are engaged in quite a serious inquiry in reading Temple Grandin and others, trying to apprehend what the question is about the animal that we're trying to understand now. So at some level, I mean, it's an interesting thing that you identify this as a more naturalistic solution, precisely because the absolute limit of the skull of the animal is a kind of a closed cathedral to us. We can't apprehend that. But what we can apprehend is what the intimacy and proximity liberates or constrains in ourselves.
Just on a practical level, I'm curious what the horses are made of and also how heavy they are.
There is a bridge of aluminium. The spine of the horse is made of aluminium, and that is supported on in the air on two backpacks, also made of aluminium. So the bridge that can hold a rider is strong. And then hung off that are pre-molded cane. The cane is soaked in water until it's floppy, and then you mold it in a mold of made of nails on a board until it's dried, and then it retains its shape, and then it's all wired together until it's really dry, and then it's bound with waxed thread. So it's a very laborious process. The horse weighs about nearly 40 kilos, so it's 20 kilos on each person, and when there's a rider on the back, they're supporting between 50 and 60 kilos on each of their backs. And so those scenes are not very long. I think the thing about animals for me, though, is that long ago, before cities, people did have a closer investment in the well-being of animals. And now when the forests are coming down and you can, through some kind of secret network, enjoy a nice chimpanzee steak in Brussels, in secret restaurants, they do that. There is a need for people to eat this illicit meat. You know, we've become so divorced from, and we are going to lose them, just like we will lose the forest. And perhaps it's sentimental to think that we can think into their brains. But I think more and more, you know, and is it a middle class thing that we love our animals like more than poor people or something? I don't know. I have really, really enjoyed the necessity of trying to penetrate into an animal's consciousness. It has been a...
Just to add something to that. We quite often as puppeteers asked why puppets, and one of the answers to that is because puppetry can introduce into a theatrical environment parts of our lives as human beings that no other form can introduce into a theatrical environment, that have been missing from theatrical environments. And the truth is that there are very few plays that have been written about animals and our lives with animals, even though animals are very important to us. They are essential to our humanity and to our whole ecology, yet they are absent from our theater. And one of the big offers, I think, of puppetry and quite a naturalistic presence of animals is because animals can't be other than naturalistic. That is their very phenomenological state. We as puppeteers are able to to enter these beings into our theatre environment. I think that's a really important offer that we make. And there are two more offers that come to mind in this regard, which I'll just mention. One is very young children, infants, for instance, and as Jane mentioned, the infant in Wojciech is one such. But we haven't, as a company, we haven't really dealt with infants as beings with affect in our lives. Yet children and infants are very much part of our humanity's lives. You find them, there are huge dramas that involve very young children that have never been brought into the theatre. They are all dramas that are yet to be written and yet to be enacted by puppets, but they will happen and they will be written, I think, because it is something that puppets can offer. And then very old people also, puppets do well, but you can act a very old person. It's harder to act an infant.
Yeah, we can pass it over that way. Sorry.
We're also puppeteers over in this side of the world are also often faced with the why puppets question. It's such a big, it's a hot button topic for all of us. I was just involved in a production in which myself and two other puppeteers were all involved in performing Anne Frank as a marionette. I think you guys know Matt. It was a really interesting. I forgot about everybody else. sorry about that. It was a really interesting challenge on a number of levels, partially because of the immense responsibility of enlivening, incorporating, performing, inhabiting this character. For us and also for the production. And there was a general feeling that there was no other way. A child actor performing Anne Frank would have had such spectacular limitations and also such provide a completely different read dramaturgically in the production, what would be possible. I think so much related to not just Anne Frank's iconic status, but also because she was a child, children, like animals, I think, as you just said, are simply what they are. Their job is to be what they are. And there's something, looking at your work, the immense catalog of your work over so many years, I wonder if you could comment on the space that puppetry has cleared with your audiences for a kind of dialogue. You've spoken about a kind of theatricality that might emerge through the introduction of puppetry, but how have your audiences responded differently, or how has your audience response been enriched by bringing these elements into the conversation?
It's quite hard to know, you know, because we didn't do the survey of all the audiences. But I suppose it makes me think of the very first adult play we did, which puppeteers who saw it said this should never be done as a puppet play, because it was a naturalistic, it was originally a radio play written by an exiled South African writer who was banned in our country, and we just happened to find his play in Botswana where books weren't banned like they were at home. And it was a play about two white women on a farm who nurture a wounded black activist who's the police are looking for. And they are sympathetic to his cause because they happen to be lovers, and they have been ostracized in the town, and they live on this farm away from that kind of pressure. And they empathize with this guy's struggle, and they look after him he dies, and the metaphor is that you can't kill the revolution, and he starts popping up everywhere. So that was called Episodes of an Easter Rising. And I had this play. We weren't trained as actors, and we did children's plays trying to learn the profession. And I thought, well, if we don't do this play now, we probably never will, because there was no tradition of adult puppet theatre in South Africa. And so we just did. We built the puppets, and we hired a theatre, and we put on our most popular children's play during the day, and kept the last week for this show and did it at night. As the opening date got closer, the two actresses who were playing the women were starting to get very worried that their professional careers were on the line, and that they wouldn't be able to hold their head up in the theatrical firmament of Cape Town. We had a fundraising evening, and people sold tickets, so the audience weren't there voluntarily. the first night, and strangely enough, it really worked. We were completely knocked out by the way people like to think of. This was in 1985. You know, Nelson Mandela was released in 1990, so we were all hoping that something was going to change in South Africa, and yet it wasn't happening. We thought it would be another 20 years, and the warmth with people. Which they identified with these little puppets. They were string puppets. They were naturalistic. They sat around a table and drank water. That's what they did. There wasn't much. There was no fantasy in the play at all. And yet people got right into the situation that they depicted. And, you know, we got known in the country through that little play, because it was just at the right time for puppets in South Africa.
If I could add to that, also one of the astonishing things with puppetry is that you're working with prostheses. So in a circumstance where one's identity is so overdeterminately given, particularly in terms of race in South Africa, to have an instrument through which you can have an elective identity, that's a pretty astonishing liberation for performers to have, that you can identify yourself across modes of representation, and that you can effectively also, as I was suggesting here, shift the figure between different performers with total disregard for the given of what you are. So it's an enormous optimism where the work of culture can in some ways remediate for the work of nature when nature has become an instrument of oppression. So, you know, I think something, and, you know, Adrian generally works with gelatong, which is a kind of a colorless wood, and so anybody can be anything. Mm. Pretty damn fine.
Mm. Yeah, we decided not to paint the wood ever after a while, and just allow the context.
Yeah.
Is there an animal that we haven't yet made that we'd like to make? Well, we have a crazy bird in South Africa called a hardy-daw, which looks a bit like a pterodactyl, and they have a long beak. They're a kind of ibis, but they're not as beautiful as the sacred ibis of Egypt. They're tawny and sort of got a shiny brown color, and they look like somebody made a mistake when when they were given their structure, but they are very characterful birds, and they squawk, and they've got a very lovely presence in all of our cities now.
They have a sort of
Yeah.
Well, we start off with the training. We hide the puppets. We don't show them the horses because they might be too attractive or too daunting or too something, and we want them to start learning principles first. And so we run a two-day period where we work just with paper. We make quick puppets, three operator puppets out of brown paper. Just you make a puppet in 10 minutes and it's stuck together with tape. And they can be very eloquent and you can learn a lot from them, but it's about teamwork. There are three people on each of these brown paper people. And so before we get into the needs of the horse, which involves a huge amount of plodding around, walking in a rhythm of a horse, getting their footfalls correct, and being able to lift in the right rhythm, because it's astonishing how when you get that right, it sounds like a horse. So the mastering of walking, trotting, and galloping comes next. There's a lot of information about what the horse behavior, what the ears do.
Are the actors who perform with the puppet train with the puppeteers, are they actors also in that training?
No, they only come first week of rehearsal, which is 2 weeks later. But what we do have to train the actors to do is to fill in the gaps that the puppet isn't, because the puppet is a series of cane lines. It doesn't have a nice, smooth, beautiful, muscular skin. And we have to teach them how to describe that skin to the audience with their hand. And it's sort of roughly in the air. They have to sort of mime how beautiful it is to feel the muscle. And when the horse blows on the hand, of course, there's no air coming out of the nostrils. They've got to act that. They've got to feel. They've got to tell you how pleasurable it is for Albert to feel the breath of Joey, because there's nothing there.
Why don't you just repeat the question?
I was curious to hear more about what it was like to come from South Africa in the 90s, making art there, and now coming to New York and to London, how it's different now you're an established company.
Yeah. It was very hard, obviously, being South Africans and traveling around in the early days. There was a cultural boycott. We decided in the ANC, when we were in Botswana, we were part of an ANC cultural group, and led by Wally Soroti, very well-known poet and activist. And the cultural boycott was born during those times, and it was agreed that that South Africa people on the left would not participate in cultural events in other countries. When we formed our company and made this play, Episodes of an Easter Rising, we made a decision not to obey that boycott and to break that boycott by taking the show to a festival in France in 1985, which was the first year of the emergency. I never believed in isolating artists on the left from each other. I thought that it was important for artists to have dialogue and not to be separated. So that was an active decision. But when we got to France and we were buzzing about members of our company. I'm not going to tell this. I'm going to mention the name of this person now. Agent's getting anxious. This was a big international festival of puppetry that happens once every 3 years. Everyone in puppetry was there. And there was a very, very famous puppeteer, one of the most famous in the world, who was there. And one of our puppeteers went to a workshop, was taken to a workshop that this puppeteer was running. And when the puppeteer found out that Odette was from South Africa, this puppeteer said, "Get out of my workshop." And she was so upset. She was terribly, terribly upset because the piece that we were doing was actually a very political piece. When people saw it, they said, "Well, you clearly can't go back to South Africa." In actual fact, we could and we did, but it was a political piece. And she was so upset that when we were waiting to perform the show, we only had one performance because we were a bit of a hot potato as a South African company. Adrian and I were hidden on that side of the stage. The audience had already come in. There was a blank stage, and then the two girls were on the other side. And Odette was just weeping. She couldn't stop crying because of that experience. And when we went out to perform, it was our one time. Our friends had given us money to help us to travel. It was a huge moment for us, and yet this prejudice from a puppeteer very much on the left against someone just because she was white had almost derailed our whole show, and could have been. It was a very important moment for us because, in fact, everyone involved in puppetry, all the important people, did come to that show. Did come to that one performance, and it kind of made our reputation, but it was very wobbly. And at that time, we were finding ourselves having to talk in French to journalists and to other people to kind of say that although it doesn't seem like it, there are people who are white who are against the government. You know, this happens all over the world. People can't believe that there is a minority that actually opposes the government. So, you know, it happens in any conflict. But this was the person who perpetrated this awful act should have known better. We went through very difficult times. Inside the country, when we were touring as a mixed group to caravan parks, and we went to a pub and we were dancing with each other, people threw peanuts at us, and you know, and if we arrived at the school to perform and we were a mixed group, there was consternation because they didn't know how to deal with the fact that there'd be a black person in the white staff room, but. We never had serious problems of real persecution. We never had a play banned. I think that the state regarded theatre as not much of a threat. Publications, newspapers, and film and television were much more of a threat, and people involved in those media were seriously persecuted and sometimes killed. We had a kind of an easy ride, I guess.
One of the other things, you know, around this question of the cultural boycott, that's a pretty complex issue still under contested discussion now, and that is because people of conscience are the ones who withhold themselves in a time of cultural boycott. And so the implications were for South Africa that bad culture overwhelmed us. So we got really tawdry American TV shows, so Woody Allen wouldn't allow his movies to be there, you know, people who were really engaged in the debate about social equity and justice withheld their work from us, and we were totally Coca-Colonized, so that, you know, that sense of the implications of a cultural boycott, I think, need to be thought through quite carefully because the it needs a pretty nuanced instrument for that not to have the opposite of the end to which it's intended.
You mentioned working with William Kentridge, and I wondered if there were other companies or individuals in South Africa or internationally with whom you've collaborated on other productions that have been really momentous.
Our big major collaboration, obviously, was with the National Theatre, more of a challenge was our collaboration with Sogolon, the puppet troupe from Mali in Warhorse. Tall Horse, get mixed up. Theirs is a tradition that has been a big inspiration to us right from before we even started our company. Adrian had come home after a shopping trip to Johannesburg, to Gaborone, where we lived, with a figure, a very beautiful figure that turned out to be a puppet from Mali. And I wrote to the person from whom he bought it, who had a gallery of African art, inquired about the figure, found out that he had a whole collection of these Malian puppets called Bambara or Bamana puppets. And we, together with the director of the National Museum and Art Gallery, where I was working at the time, we borrowed this whole collection from the dealer and then persuaded the dealer to sell the collection to Botswana, to the National Museum. So suddenly I was the curator of this wonderful collection of very joyful, very architectonic, sculptural puppets. And out of that came my regard for puppetry, my respect for puppetry, because they were so eloquent and elegant. So when 20 years later the Kennedy Center suggested that we do a production with them, because we had performed at the Kennedy Center in Washington and so had they, it seemed like a dream come true. And we went there, they came to Cape Town, there was quite a bit of to-ing and fro-ing. And indeed, it was an amazing collaboration. We when we manipulated their puppets, we found them in the beginning far too inarticulate. They weren't nearly as refined as our puppets were. But in fact, what we found later on was that they had a wonderful, amazingly strong presence that could completely overpower the presence of some of our puppets. And their puppetry style was very different from ours. So we learnt a lot from them. But also they had a completely different way of their conception of time was very different to us. For them, a production would slowly evolve over a number of months or even a year, whereas we would have very definite deadlines. They never had a word, no was not a word for them. Everything was yes. And we had to listen very carefully for the no and the yes. So there was the way that their finances worked was very different from ours. We paid our people very well and very equally, whereas in their company, only the chef got paid. Nobody else really got paid very much at all. But the chef looked after not only his own, the company, but quite a broader group of people around him. And that was very contentious when we were on tour in a foreign country and our company were buying cameras and leather jackets and their company couldn't afford any of that. So it was, we had a very difficult time with them. It was sometimes nightmarish, and we had people having epileptic fits. Somebody's son died and had to be buried on a day that we had a double performance. We had a very, very tumultuous time with them, And, you know, we could spend a whole evening talking about how the disconnect and the connect between our two companies. But despite the real trials of that experience, we've always said it was worth doing. And we yeah.
Is it possible to get the visuals back up again? Is there a reason why this is off? Because I thought I'd show you again the image of the Malian... okay, so let me go there, just to remind you of the aesthetic of the Malian figures.
These are called the Malian Castellet. No, Castellet because it's the French, the colonial language in France, it's a Francophone colony. The Castellet is the French word for a Punch and Judy booth, the Guignol traditional. So it's somehow got evolved into this, which these are antelope bodies, and they have the body is made out of bent wooden hoops, all joined together with laterals, and then out of the front comes the head, which is quite heavy, and it's balanced in the body with rubber, cut rubber car tubing. So it's got a bounce in it. And when we first... because of the logistics of a performance, it ended up that South African puppeteers were in the Castellets and Malian puppeteers were in our puppets. And we realized we had to drive these things. And you aren't allowed, they've got a grass skirt to the floor, which you, in order to move forward and without tripping on the grass skirt, you've got to, you know, you've got to flick it out. And you bent double, you've got these wood things on your back, and the weight of it is resting on your head on some kind of pad, and you've got the sides of it here, and you've got to sort of walk like this. And it's what we learned was that you could get incredibly subtle movement out of this, what seemed like a great big rigid thing on you, and the magic of that skirt, that you couldn't see the puppeteer's feet, they were a total revelation to us, and yet something completely different to what we were used to.
Mary Jo Arnoldi has written a fabulous study of the Malian puppetry tradition. I think it's called Playing for Time.
Yeah.
And for those of you who are interested in pursuing it, it's a really astonishing... One of the things one also understands with the Malian puppetry, unlike Western puppetry, it is entirely integrated into a much larger ritual practice. And so one of the things that we learned from Yaya also is that different kinds of performance, different kinds of puppets are... The performance actually defines agnates, so sort of communities of males by age. So only males of a particular age would be allowed to see puppets of a particular design. So the performance itself invokes masculinity and seniority in very distinctive ways. That's hard for us to understand unless you have a sense of that context.
Yeah, that in a way, that was the missed opportunity for us, is that we for all those reasons were not able to penetrate those deep secrets, that those puppets that happen at night when only the people who are initiated into them are allowed to look at them, and I think that was the part we really wanted to know about.
Okay, last question.
Fine arts background. So how did you make the entrance into puppetry? Like, how did you, like, apprentice yourself with master puppeteers, or was it all trial and error?
You see, we both have different... Basil hated puppets. My mom was a puppeteer, so that was my entry into the profession. And I think all the puppeteers in this room will be able to testify that if you didn't go to a puppet school, the school of puppetry that you went to was each other, because it's a marginalized existence, if you like, the expertise that people have developed within their own sphere, there is an enormous sharing that goes on. Materials that are developed, I mean, I don't know if that's your experience, but
absolutely.
Yeah. In the 19th century, when the folk troops were going around fairgrounds, they held on to every secret that nobody was allowed to look at their puppets. But that's not the case now.
Okay, thanks very much, everyone.
Basil and Adrian.